Welcome to Tech Talk from RNIB Connect Radio, the RNIB's technology show for blind and partially sighted people. See technology differently.
Hello and welcome to Tech Talk. It is the technology show for blind and partially sighted people. And I am Stephen Scott, here with you for a special episode this week. And it's all about Global Accessibility Awareness Day. It's a fantastic opportunity to focus on the work of technology companies from around the world who are doing their bit to make tech more accessible to all of us. With me to discuss all of this, I've got Robin Christofferson from AbilityNet and Robin Spinks from RNIB for our special hour this week. Hi, guys.
Hello.
This is going to be confusing.
It is going to be confusing, isn't it? I've got two Robins on the show. Right, who wants to be Bob and who wants to be Rob?
Oh, that sounds painful. Can I be Robin C?
All right, I'll be Bob.
So we've got Bob and Robin, right.
Okay. You can feel the anticipation there.
I know. That was like one of those kind of X Factor reveal moments, wasn't it? Okay, well, listen, we're here.
I'm just going to be called Bob from now on, I think.
Right. Okay, I was going to change my name to Robin just for the sake of this episode, just so we could all at least feel it's one.
So that we could do a round Robin.
Hey! Oh. There's always one that has to make the jokes. Right, okay. We got together this week for a special episode all around Global Accessibility Awareness Day, of course, because it's a huge event, and it really does showcase the amount of work that's been done over the years in accessibility on a whole wide range of products that are mainstream. I mean, not just mainstream, specialists as well, but I think it's important for us today to focus on the mainstream technology because so much of it now is accessible. And I think we can talk a lot about the kind of various types of technology that's more accessible than ever. But before we get into all of that, I want to turn to you, Robin C., first of all, Robin Christofferson. What's your earliest memories of accessible technology?
Well, I think they would have to be specialists. So they would be a tape machine with a queue and review feature, which I know is a mainstream feature where you can put a tone on a tape machine so that when you do a rewind or a fast forward, then in that high speed mode, you can hear a beep. And that's the way that you would get back to a particular place. But it was a specialist device. It was by APH, the American Printing House for the Blind, and the buttons had tactile markings on them, and the sliders had markings on them. So, yeah, it was a specialist device so that we could take notes on tape. I don't know if people remember tape. Mm-hmm. Those old cassette things with the magnetic stuff that spooled through. So many memories of spaghettified tapes where the heads would have chewed up and you'd have to extricate it from the mechanism and hope that your lecture notes or whatever still survived. So yeah, I think that's probably my earliest memory of what you might call technology these days. I know that sounds really low tech, but yeah, that was, you know, a lifesaver for me.
I'm just amazed that you had to define what cassette was. that just makes me feel old right off the bat. Robin, what about you? Robin Spinks, what's your earliest memories of tech?
Yeah, I mean, I think like Robin, the cassette player with the queue and review facility, but also I've got my first ever laptop, which dates back to 1993. And get this for a spec sheet. This is a Toshiba 1910 with 4 megs of RAM, an STN LCD monochrome screen, and yeah, 33 megahertz clock speed. Is this doing it for you?
Oh,
and
yeah.
120 megabyte hard drive. And we're talking quite a bulky beast, really nicely put together, I have to add, with a little trackball mouse thing on the side of it. And I was running on that Windows 3.11 and Lunar. And that came to the grand total in 1993 of just under £1,800 for the hardware and software. Imagine that. Imagine what kind of machine you could get for that price nowadays. It's incredible, isn't it? But I just think it's a little piece of history for me because A, it still runs, and B, it's kind of indicative of how, you know, that thing about Moore's Law and about how every year the processor speed has just extended, and the capability and the memory, everything, every metric by which we measure technology has just improved kind of beyond our kind of wildest dreams. And it's encouraging to know that something of that age still runs. So yeah, that'd probably be it for me.
I'm amazed. I mean, I must be slightly older than you, because when I went to university in 88, I had a Toshiba laptop, but it wasn't running Windows. It was running DOS, and it didn't have any kind of trackball or any pointing device at all.
Wow.
And yeah, I had HAL and a synthesizer that was built in, and it had a great big knob on the front that was kind of not, it didn't come with the laptop. It would have been, you know, drilled through and inserted so that you could change the volume of your synthesizer. And so, yeah, that was an absolute lifesaver as well. No idea where it is today, but it was a similar price, I know.
I would say for me, two things actually kind of stick out in my mind. And they all started at school, and secondary school in particular, because before that, there was nothing really I was using was particularly what I would call accessible tech. I mean, cassette tape players, yes, I was using them all the time. Not for recording, though, mainly just for listening to stuff. But no, I think technology-wise, and I'm a bit younger than you guys, just saying, but you know, I remember getting my hands on this. Now, I wish I could remember the name of this thing. And I actually would, I'd still use it today if I could find it, because it was an amazing piece of kit. So simple, and kind of never been replicated since. It was a little keyboard which had a 5-line LCD display. I don't know if it was an LCD display, probably just some kind of grayscale thing. And the idea was it was a note taker. You would just sit and type on it. Now, anyone who was sighted could sit and read what they were typing onto the little grayscale, probably dot matrix type screen. And that was great. But if you couldn't read what you were writing, what I would do is I would type everything down, and I couldn't read it, but I could type everything on my notes in class. I could type them all into this thing, and then I could take it and I'd use the little, you know, the little, was it 9-pin DIN connectors that you'd plug in. You had to be very careful because of course you break the pins so easily. And then you plug one end into the little keyboard and then you plug the other end in to a Mac. And we were using Mac LC2s at that time. Mm-hmm. So going back a little bit on the Apple Mac computer range. And you had to open up a document. So like it was ClarisWorks in those days. Remember ClarisWorks? And such a cute little program, and an amazing drawing program as well. I used to muck about with. But anyway, so you'd open up the word processor and you'd draw ClarisWorks, and you had to do it in sequence, right? You had to do this in a very ordered way. So you have to open up ClarisWorks, open up your document, have it sitting there with a little cursor blinking, and then you would plug in the 9-pin DIN into the back of the Mac. And instantly, everything you'd typed would be transferred over a letter at a time over the course of maybe a couple of minutes. It would just be, suddenly the screen would just fill up with all the words that you'd just written. And it was brilliant, except for one problem, that if at any point you even just nudged the cable, it would just stop. And that was it. It lost everything. It was just terrible. But at the same time, the potential for this was pretty good. And I remember using it because I loved it, because I could take my notes and I could just work away in class and I didn't have to worry what I was typing, because I could deal with it later. I could type it and clean it up later on. And that was what I liked. And the second thing was a CCTV. My very first experience of them was at secondary school. They were built and about the size of a double-decker bus. But what you could do was you could put your paper below it. You had that XY table, you know, the whole thing would move.
Mm.
And then you would just move your paper around. You had big knobs in the front to control maybe the
They were really
contrast.
Solid back then.
Oh, I mean, you could
was
get
it
that.
Alpha Vision with this massive telescopic lens?
That's right, yeah. Down.
And that camera unit must have been 10 pounds in weight.
It was
absolutely huge. And the refresh rate was so poor that if you moved the paper more than a sort of a centimetre every 10 seconds, it would just blur on the screen into complete obscurity. So,
they were incredibly powerful. They were incredibly strong.
Just robust, I mean, weren't they? Yeah.
Oh, robust, absolutely. I mean, these things were made like tanks. And the laugh was, it had a carry handle on it.
Yeah.
Who carried this thing around? I mean, this was not a portable device by any stretch, but but equally good, and it gave me access to reading materials for the first time in a really easy way. I loved it.
And obviously that still had a CRT screen as the screen that you were looking at. So yeah, these are it's a luggable device.
Yeah, I remember the phrase that used to be used a lot by that industry at the time was transportable, which I like, because that's quite a big, broad catch-all category.
And it sounds like you need a truck.
Yeah, apparently if you can get it, if you can get it into the boot of a car, apparently it's transportable.
Yeah,
that's not quite the same thing as a portable device, is it? I mean, if social media had been around back then, I would so love to have had my profile picture of me sat on the bus with that thing, you know, just like lugging it around.
I remember
it may not be portable, but it is in fact transportable.
Two seats would be for the CCTV. And you'd have to sit in front of it, holding it, hoping the bus didn't come to a halt too quickly.
Sorry, loves, that one's occupied, yeah.
I mean, I'm so old that I remember in primary school, we would have lessons where we would listen to the radio. We would listen to programs on the radio. And then in secondary school, whenever they wanted to show a video to the class, the IT people would bring a trolley in. And this trolley had a permanent setup of, you know, great big TV and a VCR or video recorder. And yeah, you would watch this thing and then they would wheel it away again. So yeah.
I think the first question we need to ask each other is how old we all are, because Robin, you sound very similar to my age. I'm remembering all of this stuff. I used to listen to programs from the radio, BBC Schools or whatever it was at the time. Then we had Channel 4 Schools to do the programs, and the teacher, this always made me laugh, the IT people, who knew nothing about IT, by the way, their job was to record these programs, and the programs had like a 10-second run-in on screen, so you could hit the record button at the right moment in time. I mean, it's just insane when you think about it now.
So I know that I'm a dozen years older than you. I'm 48 and 49 this year.
Old.
Oh, I know.
You're only as old as you feel, though. I've just turned 46. So
yeah. Is that how you feel, or is that...
Well, do you know what? Sometimes I feel really old when I talk to kids who are like 14, 15 now. I do feel old. But then I also meet people who are younger than me who are kind of like maybe not quite as interested in technology as I am. And then I feel quite young because I think actually maybe I'm a bit more abreast of some of the stuff than they are. And that's just a personal choice. You know, it's not something they might do tree surgery for a living or whatever. So they don't have any need to be as interested in tech as I am. Yeah. So yeah, I think it depends on the company that you keep. And, you know, I kind of had a fantastic experience recently, which just put into perspective the whole issue of age for me. So I was delivering a presentation and this person stopped mid-sentence, stopped me and said, excuse me. She said, this is excellent and I'm really enjoying it, but you're probably in your 40s, right? Well, I'm 72, and let me tell you that it's a whole different ballgame when you're older and you want to try and start using technology. And before she could finish, this lady at the end of her row stood up and she said, excuse me. She said, I'm old enough to be his granny, and I'm old enough to be your mother. I've just turned 92, and I've just got myself a tablet. And I've been on Skyscanner and booked myself a flight to San Francisco. So she said, it's all age. She said, it's all up here. It's all in the mind. And there was an applause. And the 72-year-old came and found me at the coffee break. And she said, I think I've had a telling off. I said, I think you have. I said, it's all good. And for me, that just crystallizes what age is all about.
I mean, I think that the journey that we've undergone since the 80s when the personal computer came along and then the next major era was that of the smartphone, and how that has really simplified things. You know, you no longer have to read a manual to use ClarisWorks on the iPhone. It's, you know, you have to discover things. Discoverability is a challenge, but the design and the content has had to undergo so much distillation and simplification, and there's so much more discipline involved in putting things in a concise way on a device that people won't have had training to use, that are going to be using under lots of different circumstances. And this new wave of what some people call ambient computing, where you can just talk to the air and an assistant in some shape or form will give you the information or the services or the functionality that you need. So we're definitely moving in that direction where it's going to become far more intuitive. But I can see both sides of the coin there where, you know, you are as old as you feel. And if you are 90 and really excited about these options, then fantastic. Or if you're 48 and really phased by it, then, you know, that can be really daunting as well. But yeah, we live in exciting times, absolutely.
And that is where I think things have really developed, and very quickly. I mean, you know, I think back to when I was at school, and then that point from about the turn of 99 to 2000 when I left school, because I'm 37. So, you know, I left school in 99, and that was the year. I'm just a child. and I remember that year as being the beginning of pay-as-you-go mobile phones. Mm-hmm. Everyone left school that Christmas time and came back just after Christmas, my final year of school, with a brand new phone. And that was the kind of beginning of technology starting to become more mainstream and available to more people, especially mobile tech. But for us, the challenge was always making that technology accessible. And when the iPhone was launched, and remind us, Robin, what either of you, this is your quiz of the day, when the iPhone first came out?
It is 2009. 2007 was the iPhone launch, and 2009 was when VoiceOver first became available in the iPhone 3GS.
So we're talking 12 years.
Feels like a while ago.
12 years when the iPhone just appeared. And you're right, it wasn't accessible off the bat. A lot of people forget that. But we all said, and I remember sitting thinking, I actually genuinely was worried about it, because I was thinking, what am I going to do? How am I going to use this thing? If I was wanting to use this, how am I going to use a tiny little keyboard on a tiny little screen and be able to use all this and see what I'm doing? And I had better vision then than I do now. So the worry, and not stress, but you know what I mean? You worry about these things because as tech heads, we're like, hang on a minute, I want to use this stuff, but I can't. And then like you say, 2009 comes along, and quite frankly, the world changed.
I can remember working alongside some people who were extremely vociferous, and they were, you know, avid opponents of touchscreen devices. And actually at the time, I remember one of them had written to several smartphone or phone manufacturers, basically, you know, persuading and pleading with them not to go down the touchscreen route. And you fast forward a couple of years, and even think about, you know, the advent of the iPhone 3GS, VoiceOver on the 3GS, and just think about what that ultimately represented, and then think where we are now. And actually, touchscreens have been hugely liberating for people with a visual impairment. And that might sound strange, but they have been in total. You know, they're more challenging in some ways to learn and to master. But in terms of what you can do with your device, they've opened up a huge world. Wouldn't you guys say that's fair?
Absolutely. I think that it really all started with Apple with VoiceOver on the 3GS. Now, they had obviously got VoiceOver on the Mac prior to that, but with this flagship phone that was really ushering in a whole new tech sector and had such success that it then became something that they championed going forward. They saw that it was the future, and they realized that they wanted to make it as inclusive as possible. For whatever reason, you know, we will probably never know why they prioritized it quite the way they did from that point onwards, but they have done ever since. And that really ushered in to us as blind people, for example, a new age when we weren't second-class citizens that had to scramble for accessibility, whether it's accessibility patches to add on to older mobile phones, for example, with the Symbian Series 60, you know, where you had to pay a couple of £100 to get to talk in some way, shape, or form. But ever since then, we have seen a massive proliferation of accessibility out of the box. And because everybody wanted to be Apple, everybody now has taken accessibility seriously. like they never did before.
I think you're absolutely right. That's a great synopsis. You know, we should almost have a program at some point just about this, because you clearly feel, Robin, as much as I do, that that represented a huge societal change in our community, because it was a massive front and center message that said, blind and partially sighted people are included in this. They're part of this big gold rush. And step by step, become a bigger part of it. But, you know, in the absence of that, just imagine what the world would have been like and what industry progress would have been like.
I think we would have been in a very different place, because Apple is so successful and has such brand cachet that they really have led the van in this area, and people have just followed in their wake. So absolutely. Now, whether it's because Steve Jobs was always a stickler for perfection, you know, he painted the back of the fence and his dad told him off, you know, why have you wasted paint there? Nobody can see it. And he says, well, I know it's there, you know. So everything he wanted, I think it would have been a cause of great disquiet to him to see this kind of new age of computing being, you know, a huge part of their customer base being excluded in that way. It just didn't feel right. So, and it's obviously not just vision. It's right across the disability spectrum that those settings are there and are very, very powerful.
And I think there was a recognition as well that Apple had kind of put a line in the sand in terms of blind people being able to use computers, traditional computers, and that at some point that had to continue in the trajectory of the iPhone. You know, it was a no-brainer. And there was also a precedent that legislation would ultimately require it. So to be ahead of the curve, you know, get in first and do it and be the first to do the world's first gesture-based screen reader. And it brings to mind, you know, some conversations that I had personally at the time with senior execs in Google in the US, where we were basically saying to them in early 2010, guys, take a look at this, because you've maybe not used it, but have a look. You know, and what we'd love you to do is just tell us what your thinking is. What are your plans? Because you're taking on the iPhone. You want to, you know, you're developing Android. You want this to be a serious competitor. Just tell us what you reckon you could do. And, you know, could we help you to get some of it underway? The conversations were like that at that point. And I remember the penny dropping in a couple of meetings in particular, where there seemed to be some consensus that this has got to happen on the Google platform. In some shape or form, this has got to happen, and we need to get it out there. And you know, TalkBack kind of existed in a basic form and then developed significantly, probably not until 2012, I would argue, that we saw a really big change in what TalkBack could ultimately do. But, you know, it's been the catalyst. There's no doubt about it, you know. And then with the iPad, kind of similarly into that new category of tablet computing, which of course existed before, but nobody had really energized it and put any serious marketing behind it and thought creatively about how it could exist in a consumer product.
Absolutely. And we have seen such a shift from specialist to mainstream inclusive design. Out of the box, you know, an iDevice, for example, will cover so many more people's needs than any mainstream device before it. But it's also this hugely powerful platform for third-party apps to go that extra mile in any given direction. You know, you might have the ability to provide specialist AAC systems for people who can't speak, for example, augmentative and alternative communication, which would have cost thousands of pounds before, but now is either free or just a few pounds and of equal power on a tablet or a smartphone. And similarly for, you know, note takers for blind people, for example, or environmental control systems for people who can't control things with their hands themselves. There are so many areas where what were very, you know, the domain of very specialist, very, very expensive, and frankly, not very current technologies because of the, you know, the scale of the R&D budgets for these very small companies are now going completely mainstream. And we're at the vanguard, we're at the cutting edge as much as everybody else.
I'm sitting here listening to you both, and, you know, I'm hearing what you're saying. And what I'm getting from you both is that if Apple hadn't done this, if Apple hadn't gone down this route of putting VoiceOver in the smartphone, this wouldn't have happened from anybody else. This would just wouldn't have happened at all.
I think legislation in the US, particularly in relation to education and consumer goods, I think ultimately that would have required some response. And Apple, you know, Apple were always the people who would most likely resolve this challenge first. You know, it could have been another company. It could have been Google. Would it have been packaged and put together in quite the same way in an integrated nature? Probably not. But, you know, they were the obvious people to get this off the blocks and to begin to champion it inside the education sphere as well. And, you know, there are cynics out there who will say, right, okay, Apple brought the iPad about with a view to embedding it in education across the world, and that wouldn't have been possible without some form of screen reader, screen magnification being embedded in it. That's probably true. So, you know, knowing that that product was coming along shortly after the iPhone, and in fact, if you read your Apple trivia and your Apple kind of stories and analysis, the iPad actually was meant to come out before the iPhone. And at a stage in the design process, it was basically flipped and the emphasis went on to the iPhone. And the iPhone then became available first as a consumer product. But at the time that the iPhone launched, Apple had already done a lot of work on a tablet and the iPad project was well underway. So, it's interesting. I think Apple are the obvious people to do it first. Would it have happened had Apple not done it? Who knows? But I think ultimately legislation rightly would demand that consumer electronics companies create, particularly for phones and tablets, create a operating system that we could use.
I think that Apple, having made the decisions that they made to make their devices as inclusive as possible, certainly kickstarted it took it to a completely new level, the commitment to doing things in an inclusive way and building in accessibility settings, really very capable, fully functional accessibility settings out of the box. And were we going to get there in the end because of legislation? Perhaps. And that probably would come down to market forces, like, you know, Section 508, which required it if they wanted to sell those products to the education sector, as Robin was saying. But Microsoft, who I think have always been a champion of accessibility, and if Windows, and there was talking about the disquiet when at first, you know, all touchscreen phone came along, the disquiet when we went from DOS to a GUI interface, graphical user interface with Windows 3.0 was monumental. You know, blind people all over the world were extremely worried that this would be the end of their, you know, career prospects, etc. That, you know, Microsoft's commitment there has meant that accessibility has remained alive and kicking. Having said that, though, it's only now in 2018/19, for 30 years later, that they are doing a fully functional screen reader, for example. I would argue, the result of the other screen readers being so much more functional in comparison. So,
You mean that Narrator is no longer the screen reader to get you to the place to download another screen reader?
That's right, yeah. So this reinvigoration of the accessibility aspect of the business case of being a successful, ethical, you know, corporation that's future-facing has definitely been driven by Apple, and their commitment has been unwavering, whereas the others might go more in fits and starts. You know, there was a brilliant earnings call, which every quarter Apple and every other company has to do to their investors, the people that are, you know, putting their hard-earned cash into those companies and want to see a return. So they're very, very skeptical about doing things that don't have an immediate financial benefit for them. There was one investor, a very, very large investor into Apple stock, was quizzing Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, saying, look, you know, is this really good value to plow all this money into accessibility? You know, is it really going to give us a good return on our investment? And Tim Cook basically said, in no uncertain terms, if you don't think that money spent on accessibility of our products is money well spent, you're in the wrong stock. So basically he's saying that, you know, this is important stuff. We are not going to back down on this or deprioritize it. He probably could then have gone on to say that actually there's a fantastic business case for accessibility, because inclusive design in this extreme computing age where we're using our devices in all kinds of circumstances, where everybody, regardless of whether they've got a permanent disability or impairment, is temporarily disabled on a daily basis. We've all, I guarantee it, used our phones one-handed today. And yeah, then for that period, you are temporarily motor or dexterity impaired. So you have exactly the same requirements as somebody that has that impairment 24/7, albeit for a brief time. And that can go for all the other disabilities as well. I could give you another dozen examples, but basically inclusive design is now no longer for those disabled customers. It's for everybody on a daily basis. So, you know, there is a very strong business case, and I'm sure Apple have their eye on that as well. You know, because if there's one company that is concerned about the bottom line, it's Apple.
I mean, there's one other thing I would say on this regarding Apple. And that is, and it, again, it depends who you talk to. The folks over at the National Federation of the Blind in the States will tell you perhaps a different story of how Apple's accessibility plans came to bear. Now, we will never know exactly how, as you've both said, how the decision was taken for this accessibility to be rolled out to all devices as it now is. Not just the iPad, not just the iPhone, but the Apple TV, the Apple Watch, all of their products have got accessibility in them to some degree. Even the HomePod has got accessibility built in, and it's brilliant. But going back to the days of what was called iTunes U, and again, this leads from what you guys have said about education. iTunes U was the university materials, I guess. I mean, as a guy who's never been to uni, I have no idea. But I guess it was a place you would get like uni materials and stuff. Mm.
You could follow every lecture of Harvard and Yale. And, you know, you could take a science degree or a biochemical engineering degree. Just not, you know, you could take all the courses, just not the exam.
Yeah, I wouldn't even take the exam, if I'm honest. But anyway, so, I mean, all that stuff is available to anybody who could see it. But if you wanted to read it accessibly, well, you'd have a problem. And that was something that the National Federation of the Blind got in touch with Apple about. They tried to come to a resolution and then ended up kind of forcing it a bit further than that, to the extent that Apple relented and said, okay, let's make it accessible. And the belief is that it was at that point that possibly Steve Jobs, who would have had the final say, said, right, we have to do this. And do you know what? If we're going to do it, we're going to do it right. And we're going to do it across every device.
Yeah. I think it's a bit like, you know, and I love that Tim Cook anecdote that Robin shared. I just think it's so powerful. And what a warm up to Global Accessibility Awareness Day as well. And, you know, it's, there are some things that Apple, they use this phrase just and right. And they consider that there are certain things that are just and they're right, and therefore you don't need to put a financial metric against them. And I think that philosophy is incredibly powerful. They've demonstrated that it works many times over. You know, we're all proofs that it works. And it's just powerful to be able to tell that to other companies and get other people to enter into that way of thinking, that it, there are things that go beyond the bottom line because they're the right thing to do. They're just, they're about creating a more equal society, nudging the dial, you know, whatever the phrase you want to use is, just doing something that makes society better. And people are only too happy to share their accounts of where that's happened, you know. And I remember emailing Steve Jobs when I got my first iPad, and I sent him my story about basically, you know, struggling with screens all my life and using magnification and getting the iPad and finding it a real genuine breakthrough for me as a content consumption and creation device to some level. And I sent them this email and I got a response back saying, you know, this is amazing. Thank you so much. And in the Walter Isaacson book, there's reference to an email from a guy in the UK about his iPad. And I'll never know whether that was me, but, you know, he was happy to engage. It's incredible. He was happy to hear those stories. He responded personally in very short, kind of one or two line emails, but God, he responded, which is amazing.
That's pretty incredible, actually. Even just the email response is amazing, but you're in the book as well. Wow.
Well, I don't know if it's me, but it's somebody clearly who was on.
Probably you.
And it was,
yeah.
But it was an at length email about all of the ergonomic factors that are associated with sitting at a screen as a person with low vision and crouching and bending into it and getting a bad back and a sore neck. And then all of a sudden, having this device that gave you this incredible bright canvas with magnification, you could have the tilt angle wherever you wanted it. If you're somebody like me who gets your best angle of viewing, not by looking straight at something, but looking very slightly off center, perfect. The iPad is your tool. So I was just giving them some consumer feedback on this and saying, look, well done. This is incredible. I know it's the start of a journey, but my God, I'm on this journey for every version, which I have been. And I was kind of delighted to just get a quick response. But I think it has been, just as one example, we're really beginning to sound like fanboys now, but, you know, it's all levels, isn't it? It's levels of relative fanboys.
Well, I think it is fanboyism to some degree, but I also think this technology means more to us because ultimately it's available to us, right? So we've got access to this stuff. And the way that others will evangelize over Apple because they just love it because it's great and it's amazing and it's got this and it's got that, that's wonderful. But for us, for blind people and partially sighted people, it goes
a lot further, doesn't it?
Yeah. We gravitate to what works for us and we become loyal. And I genuinely think that's how blind people work, you know, across the board, not just with tech, but with everything. If you get a job, you know, you will do well in that job because you'll fight to do well for it because you fought hard enough to get the blooming thing. So I think with this, that's why a lot of blind people tend to gravitate towards Apple. It's why I get criticized endlessly about my talking about Apple and all the rest. What I try to say to people is, look, there are alternatives out there, lots of alternatives, go try them. And, you know, we are at a point, where in 2019, we have got a very good alternative for a smartphone now in Android. The Google Pixel devices are brilliant. The new Google Pixel 3A, which is out. Wow. I mean, you know, £400 for a smartphone with all the capability in it, full accessibility, much cheaper than any iPhone you're going to find unless they bring out an SE2.
That's good news for everybody when that happens. You know, that I saw something earlier on that was basically saying that what Google have done with their Pixel 3a and 3a XL devices will actually be market changing for the whole industry because nobody else has offered a premium feature like a premium camera, which let's face it, is one of the major differentiators at the moment. Mm-hmm. No one's offered a premium camera experience at a mid-tier price and they've done it. You know, Samsung and Apple have products in the market for £750, which they believe address that market need. Now, clearly, Google has given them a real run for their money by saying, look, let's knock another £350 off the price, almost halving it again. And we're going to give you a cracking piece of hardware where all of the downgrades, if you like, all of the cost savings are mostly invisible. Older processor, polycarbonate body, slightly different display, slightly different memory, etc. They're all fairly, you know, hard to notice things unless you're a real tech nerd.
I think that where we are today with smartphones that are as powerful as they are, and you mentioned the camera, and people might be wondering if they're not already kind of familiar with how blind people can, you know, best use tech on a day-to-day basis. You might think that, well, why are we interested in the camera, for example? I mean, blind people probably use their camera on their smartphones more than the average person under the age of whatever age people are when they're taking 50 selfies a day. I'm not quite sure. Certainly my kids haven't reached the age where they stop taking selfies of themselves all the time. But, you know, we use the camera and the smarts built into the software to recognize text, to, you know, read letters from the doctor or the bank or menus in a restaurant. We recognize objects. We recognize people's faces. We use the AR capabilities built into smartphones these days to track our progress as we walk through the corridors and rooms in a building. And the AR finds the edges of doorways and sees tabletops and counters and effortlessly guides us around them using verbal commands on a real-time basis. You know, we are actually living in the future with a device that, as Robin's just said, has all the power of the high-end phones in a really affordable price. So Apple's leading the way, but other providers have taken it upon themselves not to compromise on what high-end iPhones, for example, offer, but doing it at a much more affordable and still very inclusive level. And I think that, you know, these devices, for me, I used to carry around a backpack full of specialist devices. I had a talking note taker, a talking MP3 stroke audio book text file, you know, reader, the book courier. I don't know if you guys remember that. I had a talking barcode scanner, a talking GPS device, the Trekker Breeze. That was 750 quid. Each one of these in a backpack, I probably had £5,000 or £6,000 worth of specialist devices. None of them were mainstream. They all had different chargers, you know, that I would have to carry around as well and hope that I plugged the right one in to the right device so it didn't, you know, burn out the circuitry or whatever. And all of those are gone. And they're all replaced by a smartphone with either free or very cheap apps and absolute cutting edge. You know, every time something is improved in these phones, then the developers, and there are many, many of, you know, many hundreds of them out there that are deciding that they're going to create very specialist apps for the blind community, for example, they're able to leverage those within weeks and produce the next fantastic thing that helps blind people to, you know, be more employable, take more advantage of leisure and, you know, life choices, outside work, get educated more easily, be active on online in, you know, the ever more increasingly digital driven lifestyle that we have. So yeah, we live in really, really exciting times, and we haven't even started to talk about what things are just around the corner as well.
Well, that's a good point for us to talk about that kind of thing, because we've talked a lot about smartphones. We've talked a lot about the reason, and I think it's a really, you know, this is weighing out well, because, you know, we've talked to the majority of this episode about smartphones, and actually that's because they are probably the things we gravitate to most of all in our lives. But there are a lot of new emerging technologies out there. And before we get into some of them, which I think are starting to change the way we think about accessibility, I just wanted to pick on one particular area that is changing more and more, and actually has only really been in the last couple of years, something which matters a lot to most of us, although not Robin Christofferson, I might add. That is television, Robin Spinks. Tell us how that's been developing and getting more accessible.
Well, I guess in parallel with the development of the smartphone industry and following on from that, we've seen the advent of smart TVs, so TVs that are connected to the internet and can run apps which are designed and curated specifically for that particular TV platform. We've seen huge changes there from, I guess, going back to maybe 2007, 2008, where we saw audio description capability being built into Sony Bravia TVs. That was a big frontier at the time. And then within a couple of years of that, we had voice guidance beginning to appear in an elementary form where, you know, information about channels and programs and so on could be spoken out. And then moving into the kind of major TV platforms, so Samsung have the Tizen platform. And on that TV platform, there is baked-in accessibility, which Samsung and RNIB have worked on for a number of years, in fact. And that's been about building in a good accessibility experience into the smart TV platform from scratch. So whether you buy the cheapest television in the range, which is about £300, or the dearest, which is about £4,000, or any of them in between, you get the same accessibility experience. So you would get, for example, something called Voice Guide, which would mean that when you had that this feature turned on in settings, everything that appears on screen in the form of channel information, program information, up next information, timings, would be spoken out to you. And you would also have a spoken control menu. So when you pressed a button, it would be able to tell you what that was. All the feedback would be spoken out. And we've seen that develop year on year for the past 3 years. It's getting richer every year. But it basically now means that if you want a smart TV experience, for the most part, you're no longer in a position where you've got to add on extra hardware, as was the case in the past. People added costly set-top boxes on to make things happen. You've got it rightly, you've got it integrated into the operating system. And one of the challenges now is to get people who create the apps for those TV platforms to recognize that users might be using Voice Guide or might be using Magnification, for example, as part of the TV suite of features. So the work continues in terms of the advocacy work, because it's not just about making the platform accessible. It's clearly about the content that's created for that platform being accessible, and indeed continuing to have accessibility built in with each new version. So we've seen a huge amount of progress on TV. We've also seen, of course, things like Apple TV, you know, has dedicated plug-in boxes for Apple's own platform. They've had pretty good accessibility for a long time now. Again, I think the community feedback on that is really, really encouraging. And it's, you know, it's just right. It's right that that should happen from scratch with every TV manufacturer. We've seen Android TV, the latest version, has a lot more accessibility built into it. And, you know, we're edging closer to a time where any TV manufacturer, if you nip down to the supermarket and buy a spare telly for your spare room and you open the box, you should be able to turn on that TV and have an accessibility experience from the word go without doing anything. We're not there yet, but we're edging a little bit closer.
And that is where I think I'd like to talk about a new era of technology that we've started seeing, certainly in the last couple of years. We've seen it come into play. I think Christmas time just there was probably the kind of launch pad for a lot of this, with the amount of these new devices being sold. And what I'm talking about here are smart speakers. I would say that this type of device, the smart speaker, is blurring the line between what on a phone or on a TV or on any device, on a computer, you know, you've got accessibility tools on one side, and you've got the experience on the other. And, you know, together they work, but they are separate. They live apart. You've got to turn one on to, you know, work with the other. Whereas with a smart speaker, all of that's blurred into one. And it changes because, you know, in an Amazon Echo case or a Google Home case, we're talking about a device that you just speak to and it responds. And that's about as accessible and as about as mainstream as you can get.
And I think that this brings together all the platforms that we've been talking about before, because the promise of these smart speakers is to usher in the age of ambient computing, where you can just talk to the air and something will respond in an intelligent way. So just last week, we heard the announcement that a lady, I'm not going to say her name because there's one very close to me here, Alexa, will be live for people to query without pressing any button or clicking your mouse on every Windows 10 PC going forward. So the update that's about to hit PCs across the world can have that capability. If you download that app from their store, you can see this built into devices such as smart TVs, or indeed those plug-in TVs. If you've got a dumb TV or you just don't like the smarts within your smart TV, you can choose to live within the ecosystem of another one that you can plug in very easily, and then the A-Lady will be available there, or a Google Home if it's an Android-based operating system there. You can have them built into wearables so that as you're walking along, your earbuds will be listening to answer your requests, etc. So going forward, I think this is definitely the way we're going. It doesn't mean that it's audio only. If these devices are done in an inclusive way, and the Amazon Echo is a really good case in point, then you can type or tap to her instead of talking, and you can get live captions of everything that is spoken out on those smart speakers that have a screen. So these, whilst being sort of a natural language first type interface, and the promise going forward of a really intuitive way of interfacing with the digital world, they are going to be inclusive. And this idea of inclusive design that, as we spoke about before, I think really has become the morally thing that everyone will do, because they know that if they didn't, the world has moved on and they wouldn't be able to defend that position. So I think going forward, we're going to see these devices being accessible out of the box, and you will have so much choice in how you interface with technology, whether it's on your wrist, in your ears, built into your smart glasses, or just, you know, scattered around your building. You'll be able to take advantage of what these devices have to offer, which is, by the way, blooming and burgeoning with thousands of additional third-party capabilities on a weekly basis, that we will, you know, as blind or disabled people, have almost as many choices. I'm certainly not going to say as many, because there are always edge cases, but I think we're part of the 80% now and not the 20% that we were in before.
I think it's a great summary, Robin, and I was really keen to see what your response to that was. Absolutely, it's everywhere. And I think, you know, in addition, I think what we'll start to see is a whole proliferation of devices around the home. So particularly thinking here about kitchen devices like washing machines and tumble dryers and dishwashers, where we know there are very significant accessibility challenges, but where we also know that combining the capability of the A-Lady or the G-Lady, we can actually make those devices work. In tandem with a smart speaker, we can have access to control systems that are today inaccessible to us because of design trends. So I'm talking here about things like purely touch panel based displays and infinity dials, where you turn a dial round and round and round, and all it does is cycle through digital information. It doesn't have a start point or an end point that it might have had, say, 5 years ago. So those interface trends are making it much more difficult for blind people in particular to purchase white goods. But the smart speakers have the capability to, once appropriately leveraged, they have the capability to make those control systems meaningful and make using the devices possible for people with a visual impairment. And, you know, what a great use case, because design and design trends have often worked against people because they've created a user scenario that's just not workable. And if you walk into a John Lewis, for example, and look at the washing machines or, you know, tumble dryers or dishwashers, you're increasingly seeing flat touch-based displays without any level of clickable audio control, unless you buy a very high-end model. And what we want to see, of course, is accessibility across the price band. You know, if you buy a £300 device washing machine, for example, there's absolutely no reason why that shouldn't be accessible to you as a blind person.
Absolutely. I mean, when I would go into an electronics store, electrical store, to purchase a new dishwasher or a microwave, I would be looking whether it is A-Lady compatible. That's all I'll care about. I have a microwave, for example. It's a specialist one because it's very old and there weren't these smart speaker enabled connected appliances back then. And that was £250, which back then was a lot more than it is today.
You know what always makes me smile about that is that it tells you that the door is open and the door is closed. That's a constant joke in our house.
Like, that's not. Yeah. And so that one has a specialized membrane keyboard on it, and it has built-in speech and all of that, particularly when you're working at the scale of a specialist group of customers, makes it very expensive. Whereas nowadays, Amazon do a basic microwave. It's the same wattage, 700 watts, so it's not a underpowered one, for £50, which is a lady compatible. And I won't need to know or care what the interface is, whether it's a touch screen or a, you know, simple membrane type. I won't mind about that at all, because I won't be using that. I'll be just talking to the Echo Dot that we have in our kitchen, and she'll be defrosting my pound of vegetable curry or whatever it might be to the exact requirements. You know, it would be very smart, but all the smarts won't be those additional components to make the thing speak and to adapt the control panel that would need to be built into every one of these microwaves. The connectivity with the A-Lady that I've already got, that is my accessible interface to these white appliances, is fractions of a pound probably to make that connective. And they're not doing it for us. They're doing it because everything is going to be connected. We're just riding that wave and, you know, being able to participate in a normal way.
And we haven't even touched on artificial intelligence, augmented reality, all of that technology, which autonomous vehicles. I mean, all of this tech, which is looming, some of it's already here. In fact, most of it's already here. We're just starting to see the implementation of it over the next couple of years. So, you know, next year when we all get together, and I would love us to put a date in the diary for us all to do that and get together and look at next year when we get there. I think we'll have a very different conversation again, especially with the likelihood of smart glasses coming along and how that will help push forward all of this new type of technology. But it really has been a fascinating conversation, and, you know, a great way to celebrate Global Accessibility Awareness Day, to talk about where we've been from, you know, a £700, and I'm talking weight here, a CCTV, you know, to a lovely little smartphone in your pocket. It's quite incredible. Robin Spinks from RNIB, Robin Christofferson from AbilityNet, as always, thank you both for being here.
Thanks, Stephen. Thanks, Bob.
It's been super exciting. And honestly, I'm already looking forward to the follow-up. It's been great to chat to you guys.
Well, there you go. Lots of discussion to be thought about there. And also lots for you to interact with as well. You can email techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Until next week, goodbye.